Chapter 3. A Model of the World in Your Head. What the brain does may seem obvious to you. The brain gets inputs from its sensors. It processes those inputs, and then it acts. In the end, how an animal reacts to what it senses determines its success or failure. A direct mapping from sensory input to action certainly applies to some parts of the brain. For example, accidentally touching a hot surface will cause a reflex retraction of the arm. The output-input circuit responsible is located in the spinal cord. But what about the neocortex? Can we say that the task of the neocortex is to take inputs from sensors and then immediately act? In short, no. You are reading or listening to this book, and it isn't causing any immediate actions other than perhaps turning pages or touching a screen. Thousands of words are streaming into your neocortex, and for the most part, you are not acting on them. Maybe later you will act differently for having listened to this book. Perhaps you will have future conversations about brain theory and the future of humanity that you would not have had if you didn't read this book. Perhaps your future thoughts and word choices will be subtly influenced by my words. Perhaps you will work on creating intelligent machines based on brain principles, and my words will inspire you in this direction. But right now, you are just listening. If we insist on describing the neocortex as an input-output system, then the best we could say is that the neocortex gets lots of inputs. It learns from these inputs, and then later, maybe hours, maybe years, it acts differently based on these prior inputs. From the moment I became interested in how the brain worked, I realized that thinking of the neocortex as an input-leads-to-output system would not be fruitful. Fortunately, when I was a graduate student at Berkeley, I had an insight that led me down a different and more successful path. I was at home, working at my desk. There were dozens of objects on the desk and in the room. I realized that if any one of these objects changed, in even the slightest way, I would notice it. My pencil cup was always on the right side of the table. If one day I found it on the left, I would notice the change and wonder how it got moved. If the stapler changed in length, I would notice. I would notice the change if I touched the stapler or if I looked at it. I would even notice if the stapler made a different sound when being used. If the clock on the wall changed its location or style, I would notice. If the cursor on my computer screen moved left when I moved the mouse to the right, I would immediately realize something was wrong. What struck me was that I would notice these changes even if I wasn't attending to these objects. As I looked around the room, I didn't ask, "Is my stapler the correct length?" I didn't think, "Check to make sure the clock's hour hand is still shorter than the minute hand." Changes to the normal would just pop into my head, and my attention would then be drawn to them. There were literally thousands of possible changes in my environment that my brain would notice almost instantly. There was only one explanation I could think of. My brain, specifically my neocortex, was making multiple simultaneous predictions of what it was about to see, hear, and feel. Every time I moved my eyes, my neocortex made predictions of what it was about to see. Every time I picked something up, my neocortex made predictions of what each finger should feel. And every action I took led to predictions of what I should hear. My brain predicted the smallest stimuli, such as the texture of the handle on my coffee cup, and large conceptual ideas, such as the correct month that should be displayed on a calendar. These predictions occurred in every sensory modality, for low-level sensory features and high-level concepts, which told me that every part of the neocortex, and therefore every cortical column, was making predictions. Prediction was a ubiquitous function of the neocortex. At that time, few neuroscientists described the brain as a prediction machine. Focusing on how the neocortex made many parallel predictions would be a novel way to study how it worked. I knew that prediction wasn't the only thing the neocortex did. But prediction represented a systemic way of attacking the cortical column's mysteries. I could ask specific questions about how neurons make predictions under different conditions. The answers to these questions might reveal what cortical columns do and how they do it. To make predictions, the brain has to learn what is normal, That is, what should be expected based on past experience. My previous book on intelligence explored this idea of learning and prediction. In the book, I used the phrase the memory prediction framework to describe the overall idea, and I wrote about the implications of thinking about the brain this way. I argued that by studying how the neocortex makes predictions, we would be able to unravel how the neocortex works. Today, I no longer use the phrase the memory prediction framework. Instead, I describe the same idea by saying that the neocortex learns a model of the world, and it makes predictions based on its model. I prefer the word model because it more precisely describes the kind of information that the neocortex learns. For example, my brain has a model of my stapler. The model of the stapler includes what the stapler looks like, what it feels like, and the sounds it makes when being used. The brain's model of the world includes where objects are and how they change when we interact with them. For example, my model of the stapler includes how the top of the stapler moves relative to the bottom and how a staple comes out when the top is pressed down. These actions may seem simple, but you were not born with this knowledge. You learned it at some point in your life, and now it is stored in your neocortex. The brain creates a predictive model. This just means that the brain continuously predicts what its inputs will be. Prediction isn't something that the brain does every now and then. It's an intrinsic property that never stops, and it serves an essential role in learning. When the brain's predictions are verified, that means the brain's model of the world is accurate. A misprediction causes you to attend to the error and update the model. We are not aware of the vast majority of these predictions unless the input to the brain does not match. As I casually reach out to grab my coffee cup, I am not aware that my brain is predicting what each finger will feel, how heavy the cup should be, the temperature of the cup, and the sound the cup will make when I place it back on my desk. But if the cup was suddenly heavier, or cold, or squeaked, I would notice the change. We can be certain that these predictions are occurring because even a small change in any of these inputs will be noticed. But when a prediction is correct, as most will be, we won't be aware that it ever occurred. When you are born, your neocortex knows almost nothing. It doesn't know any words, what buildings are like, how to use a computer, or what a door is and how it moves on hinges. It has to learn countless things. The overall structure of the neocortex is not random. Its size, the number of regions it has, and how they are connected together is largely determined by our genes. For example, genes determine what parts of the neocortex are connected to the eyes, what other parts are connected to the ears, and how those parts connect to each other. Therefore, we can say that the neocortex is structured at birth to see, hear, and even learn language. But it is also true that the neocortex doesn't know what it will see, what it will hear, and what specific languages it might learn. We can think of the neocortex as starting life having some built-in assumptions about the world, but knowing nothing in particular. Through experience, it learns a rich and complicated model of the world. The number of things the neocortex learns is huge. I am sitting in a room with hundreds of objects. I will randomly pick one, a printer. I have learned a model of the printer that includes it having a paper tray and how the tray moves in and out of the printer. I know how to change the size of the paper and how to unwrap a new ream and place it in the tray. I know the steps I need to take to clear a paper jam. I know that the power cord has a D-shaped plug at one end and that it can only be inserted in one orientation. I know the sound of the printer and how that sound is different when it is printing on two sides of a sheet of paper rather than on one. Another object in my room is a small two-drawer file cabinet. I can recall dozens of things I know about the cabinet, including what is in each drawer and how the objects in the drawer are arranged. I know there is a lock, where the key is, and how to insert and turn the key to lock the cabinet. I know how the key and lock feel and the sounds they make as I use them. The key has a small ring attached to it, and I know how to use my fingernail to pry open the ring to add or remove keys. Imagine going room to room in your home. In each room, you can think of hundreds of things, and for each item, you can follow a cascade of learned knowledge. You can also do the same exercise for the town you live in. recalling what buildings, parks, bike racks, and individual trees exist at different locations. For each item, you can recall experiences associated with it and how you interact with it. The number of things you know is enormous, and the associated links of knowledge seem never-ending. We learn many high-level concepts, too. It is estimated that each of us knows about 40,000 words. We have the ability to learn spoken language, written language, sign language, the language of mathematics, and the language of music. We learn how electronic forms work, what thermostats do, and even what empathy or democracy mean, although our understanding of these may differ. Independent of what other things the neocortex might do, we can say for certain that it learns an incredibly complex model of the world. This model is the basis of our predictions, perceptions, and actions. Learning through movement. The inputs to the brain are constantly changing. There are two reasons why. First, the world can change. For example, when listening to music, the inputs from the ears change rapidly, reflecting the movement of the music. Similarly, a tree swaying in the breeze will lead to visual and, perhaps, auditory changes. In these two examples, the inputs to the brain are changing from moment to moment, not because you are moving, but because things in the world are moving and changing on their own. The second reason is because we move. Every time we take a step, move a limb, move our eyes, tilt our head, or utter a sound, the input from our sensors change. For example, our eyes make rapid movements called saccades, about 3 times a second. With each saccade, our eyes fixate on a new point in the world, and the information from the eyes to the brain changes completely. This change would not occur if we hadn't moved our eyes. The brain learns its model of the world by observing how its inputs change over time. There isn't another way to learn. Unlike with a computer, we cannot upload a file into our brain. The only way for a brain to learn anything is via changes in its inputs. If the inputs to the brain were static, nothing could be learned. Some things, like a melody, can be learned without moving the body. We can sit perfectly still with eyes closed and learn a new melody by just listening to how the sounds change over time. But most learning requires that we actively move and explore. Imagine you enter a new house, one you have not been in before. If you don't move, there will be no changes in your sensory input, and you can't possibly learn anything about the house. To learn a model of the house, you have to look in different directions and walk from room to room. You need to open doors, peek in drawers, and pick up objects. The house and its contents are mostly static. They don't move on their own. To learn a model of a house, you have to move. Take a simple object such as a computer mouse. To learn what a mouse feels like, you have to run your fingers over it. To learn what a mouse looks like, you have to look at it from different angles and fixate your eyes on different locations. To learn what a mouse does, you have to press down on its buttons, slide off the battery cover, or move it across a mouse pad to see, feel, and hear what happens. The term for this is sensory motor learning. In other words, the brain learns a model of the world by observing how sensory inputs change as we move. We can learn a song without moving because, unlike the order in which we can move from room to room in a house, the order of notes in a song is fixed. But most of the world isn't like that. Most of the time, we have to move to discover the structure of objects, places, and actions. With sensory motor learning, unlike a melody, the order of sensations is not fixed. What I see when I enter a room depends on which direction I turn my head. What my finger feels when holding a coffee cup depends on whether I move my finger up or down or sideways. With each movement, the neocortex predicts what the next sensation will be. Move my finger up on the coffee cup, and I expect to feel the lip. Move my finger sideways, and I expect to feel the handle. If I turn my head left when entering my kitchen, I expect to see my refrigerator. And if I turn my head right, I expect to see the range. If I move my eyes to the left front burner, I expect to see the broken igniter that I need to fix. If any input doesn't match the brain's prediction, perhaps my spouse fixed the igniter, then my attention is drawn to the area of misprediction. This alerts the neocortex that its model of that part of the world needs to be updated. The question of how the neocortex works can now be phrased more precisely. How does the neocortex, which is composed of thousands of nearly identical cortical columns, learn a predictive model of the world through movement? This is the question my team and I set out to answer. Our belief was that if we could answer it, we could reverse engineer the neocortex. We would understand both what the neocortex did and how it did it. And ultimately, we would be able to build machines that worked the same way. Two tenets of neuroscience. Before we can start answering the previous question, there are a few more basic ideas you need to know. First, like every other part of the body, the brain is composed of cells. The brain's cells, called neurons, are in many ways similar to all our other cells. For example, a neuron has a cell membrane that defines its boundary and a nucleus that contains DNA. However, neurons have several unique properties that don't exist in other cells in your body. The first is that neurons look like trees. They have branch-like extensions of the cell membrane called axons and dendrites. The dendrite branches are clustered near the cell and collect the inputs. The axon is the output. It makes many connections to nearby neurons, but often travels long distances, such as from one side of the brain to the other, or from the neocortex all the way down to the spinal cord. The second difference is that neurons create spikes, also called action potentials. An action potential is an electrical signal that starts near the cell body and travels along the axon until it reaches the end of every branch. The third unique property is that the axon of one neuron makes connections to the dendrites of other neurons. The connection points are called synapses. When a spike traveling along an axon reaches a synapse, it releases a chemical that enters the dendrite of the receiving neuron. Depending on which chemical is released, it makes the receiving neuron more or less likely to generate its own spike. Considering how neurons work, we can state two fundamental tenets. These tenets will play important roles in our understanding of the brain and intelligence. Tenet number one. Thoughts, ideas, and perceptions are the activity of neurons. At any point in time, some neurons in the neocortex are actively spiking and some are not. Typically, the number of neurons that are active at the same time is small, maybe 2%. Your thoughts and perceptions are determined by which neurons are spiking. For example, when doctors perform brain surgery, they sometimes need to activate neurons in an awake patient's brain. They stick a tiny probe into the neocortex and use electricity to activate a few neurons. When they do this, the patient might hear, see, or think something. When the doctor stops the stimulation, whatever the patient was experiencing stops. If the doctor activates different neurons, the patient has a different thought or perception. Thoughts and experiences are always the result of a set of neurons that are active at the same time. Individual neurons can participate in many different thoughts or experiences. Every thought you have is the activity of neurons. Everything you see, hear, or feel is also the activity of neurons. Our mental states and the activity of neurons are one and the same. Tenet number two. Everything we know is stored in the connections between neurons. The brain remembers a lot of things. You have permanent memories, such as where you grew up. You have temporary memories, such as what you had for dinner last night. And you have basic knowledge, such as how to open a door or how to spell the word dictionary. All these things are stored using synapses, the connections between neurons. Here is the basic idea for how the brain learns. Each neuron has thousands of synapses, which connect the neuron to thousands of other neurons. If two neurons spike at the same time, they will strengthen the connection between them. When we learn something, the connections are strengthened, and when we forget something, the connections are weakened. This basic idea was proposed by Donald Hebb in the 1940s, and today it is referred to as Hebbian learning. For many years, it was believed that the connections between neurons in an adult brain were fixed. Learning, it was believed, involved increasing or decreasing the strength of synapses. This is still how learning occurs in most artificial neural networks. However, over the past few decades, scientists have discovered that in many parts of the brain, including the neocortex, new synapses form and old ones disappear. Every day, many of the synapses on an individual neuron will disappear and new ones will replace them. Thus, much of learning occurs by forming new connections between neurons that were previously not connected. Forgetting happens when old or unused connections are removed entirely. The connections in our brain store the model of the world that we have learned through our experiences. Every day we experience new things and add new pieces of knowledge to the model by forming new synapses. The neurons that are active at any point in time represent our current thoughts and perceptions. We have now gone over several of the basic building blocks of the neocortex, some of the pieces of our puzzle. In the next chapter, we start putting these pieces together to reveal how the entire neocortex works. Chapter 4. The Brain Reveals Its Secrets. People often say the brain is the most complicated thing in the universe. They conclude from this that there will not be a simple explanation for how it works, or that perhaps we will never understand it. The history of scientific discovery suggests they are wrong. Major discoveries are almost always preceded by bewildering, complex observations. With the correct theoretical framework, the complexity does not disappear, but it no longer seems confusing or daunting. A familiar example is the movement of the planets. For thousands of years, astronomers carefully tracked the motion of the planets among the stars. The path of a planet over the course of a year is complex, darting this way and that, making loops in the sky. It was hard to imagine an explanation for these wild movements. Today, every child learns the basic idea that the planets orbit the sun. The motion of the planets is still complex, and to predict their course requires difficult mathematics. But with the right framework, the complexity is no longer mysterious. Few scientific discoveries are hard to understand at a basic level. A child can learn that the Earth orbits the sun. A high school student can learn the principles of evolution, genetics, quantum mechanics, and relativity. Each of these scientific advances was preceded by confusing observations. But now, they seem straightforward and logical. Similarly, I always believed that the neocortex appeared complicated largely because we didn't understand it, and that it would appear relatively simple in hindsight. Once we knew the solution, we would look back and say, "Oh, of course, why didn't we think of that?" When our research stalled, or when I was told that the brain is too difficult to understand, I would imagine a future where brain theory was part of every high school curriculum. This kept me motivated. Our progress in trying to decipher the neocortex had its ups and downs. Over the course of 18 years, 3 at the Redwood Neuroscience Institute and 15 at NuMenta, my colleagues and I worked on this problem. There were times when we made small advances, times we made large advances, and times we pursued ideas that at first seemed exciting, but ultimately proved to be dead ends. I am not going to walk you through all of this history. Instead, I want to describe several key moments when our understanding took a leap forward, when nature whispered in our ear telling us something we had overlooked. There are 3 such aha moments that I remember vividly. Discovery number 1. The neocortex learns a predictive model of the world. I already described how in 1986 I realized that the neocortex learns a predictive model of the world. I can't overstate the importance of this idea. I call it a discovery because that is how it felt to me at the time. There is a long history of philosophers and scientists talking about related ideas. And today it is not uncommon for neuroscientists to say the brain learns a predictive model of the world. But in 1986, neuroscientists and textbooks still described the brain more like a computer. Information comes in, it gets processed, and then the brain acts. Of course, learning a model of the world and making predictions isn't the only thing the neocortex does. However, by studying how the neocortex makes predictions, I believed we could unravel how the entire system worked. This discovery led to an important question. How does the brain make predictions? One potential answer is that the brain has two types of neurons: neurons that fire when the brain is actually seeing something, and neurons that fire when the brain is predicting it will see something. To avoid hallucinating, the brain needs to keep its predictions separate from reality. Using two sets of neurons does this nicely. However, there are two problems with this idea. First, given that the neocortex is making a massive number of predictions at every moment, we would expect to find a large number of prediction neurons. So far, that hasn't been observed. Scientists have found some neurons that become active in advance of an input, but these neurons are not as common as we would expect. The second problem is based on an observation that had long bothered me. If the neocortex is making hundreds or thousands of predictions at any moment in time, why are we not aware of most of these predictions? If I grab a cup with my hand, I am not aware that my brain is predicting what each finger should feel. Unless I feel something unusual, say, a crack. We are not consciously aware of most of the predictions made by the brain unless an error occurs. Trying to understand how the neurons in the neocortex make predictions led to the second discovery. Discovery number two: predictions occur inside neurons. Recall that predictions made by the neocortex come in two forms. One type occurs because the world is changing around you. For example, you are listening to a melody. You can be sitting still with your eyes closed, and the sound entering your ears changes as the melody progresses. If you know the melody, then your brain continually predicts the next note, and you will notice if any of the notes are incorrect. The second type of prediction occurs because you are moving relative to the world. For example, as I lock my bicycle in the lobby of my office, my neocortex makes many predictions about what I will feel, see, and hear based on my movements. The bicycle and lock don't move on their own. Every action I make leads to a set of predictions. If I change the order of my actions, the order of the predictions also changes. Mountcastle's proposal of a common cortical algorithm suggested that every column in the neocortex makes both types of predictions. Otherwise, cortical columns would have differing functions. My team also realized that the two types of prediction are closely related. Therefore, we felt that progress on one subproblem would lead to progress on the other. Predicting the next note in a melody, also known as sequence memory, is the simpler of the two problems, so we worked on it first. Sequence memory is used for a lot more than just learning melodies. It is also used in creating behaviors. For example, when I dry myself off with a towel after showering, I typically follow a nearly identical pattern of movements, which is a form of sequence memory. Sequence memory is also used in language. Recognizing a spoken word is like recognizing a short melody. The word is defined by a sequence of phonemes, whereas a melody is defined by a sequence of musical intervals. There are many more examples, but for simplicity, I will stick to melodies. By deducing how neurons in a cortical column learn sequences, we hoped to discover basic principles of how neurons make predictions about everything. We worked on the melody prediction problem for several years before we were able to deduce the solution, which had to exhibit numerous capabilities. For example, melodies often have repeating sections, such as a chorus or the da-da-da-dum of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. To predict the next note, you can't just look at the previous note or the previous five notes. The correct prediction may rely on notes that occurred a long time ago. Neurons have to figure out how much context is necessary to make the right prediction. Another requirement is that neurons have to play name that tune. The first few notes you might hear belong to several different melodies. The neurons have to keep track of all possible melodies consistent with what has been heard so far, until enough notes have been heard to eliminate all but one melody. Engineering a solution to the sequence memory problem would be easy, but figuring out how real neurons, arranged as we see them in the neocortex, solve these and other requirements was hard. Over several years, we tried different approaches. Most worked to some extent, but none exhibited all the capabilities we needed. and none precisely fit the biological details we knew about the brain. We were not interested in a partial solution or in a biologically inspired solution. We wanted to know exactly how real neurons, arranged as seen in the neocortex, learn sequences and make predictions. I remember the moment when I came upon the solution to the melody prediction problem. It was in 2010, one day prior to our Thanksgiving holiday. The solution came in a flash, but as I thought about it, I realized it required neurons to do things I wasn't sure they were capable of. In other words, my hypothesis made several detailed and surprising predictions that I could test. Scientists normally test a theory by running experiments to see if the predictions made by the theory hold up or not. But neuroscience is unusual. There are hundreds to thousands of published papers in every subfield, and most of these papers present experimental data that are unassimilated into any overall theory. This provides theorists, like myself, an opportunity to quickly test a new hypothesis by searching through past research to find experimental evidence that supports or invalidates it. I found a few dozen journal papers that contained experimental data that could shed light on the new sequence memory theory. My extended family was staying over for the holiday, but I was too excited to wait until everyone went home. I recall reading papers while cooking and engaging my relatives in discussions about neurons and melodies. The more I read, the more confident I became that I had discovered something important. The key insight was a new way of thinking about neurons. Please refer to the PDF for a picture of the most common type of neuron in the neocortex. Neurons like this have thousands, sometimes tens of thousands, of synapses spaced along the branches of the dendrites. Some of the dendrites are near the cell body, which is toward the bottom of the image, and some dendrites are farther away, toward the top. The box shows an enlarged view of one dendrite branch, so you can see how small and tightly packed the synapses are. Each bump along the dendrite is one synapse. I've also highlighted an area around the cell body. The synapses in this area are called proximal synapses. If the proximal synapses receive enough input, then the neuron will spike. The spike starts at the cell body and travels to other neurons via the axon. The axon was not visible in this picture, so I added a down-facing arrow to show where it would be. If you just consider the proximal synapses and the cell body, then this is the classic view of a neuron. If you have ever read about neurons or studied artificial neural networks, you will recognize this description. Oddly, less than 10% of the cell's synapses are in the proximal area. The other 90% are too far away to cause a spike. If an input arrives at one of these distal synapses, like the ones shown in the box, it has almost no effect on the cell body. All that researchers could say was that the distal synapses performed some sort of modulatory role. For many years, no one knew what 90% of the synapses in the neocortex did. Starting around 1990, this picture changed. Scientists discovered new types of spikes that travel along the dendrites. Before, we knew of only one type of spike. It started at the cell body and traveled along the axon to reach other cells. Now, we'd learned that there were other spikes that traveled along the dendrites. One type of dendrite spike begins when a group of 20 or so synapses situated next to each other on a dendrite branch receive input at the same time. Once a dendrite spike is activated, it travels along the dendrite until it reaches the cell body. When it gets there, it raises the voltage of the cell, but not enough to make the neuron spike. It is like the dendrite spike is teasing the neuron. It is almost strong enough to make the neuron active, but not quite. The neuron stays in this provoked state for a little bit of time before going back to normal. Scientists were once again puzzled. What are dendrite spikes good for if they aren't powerful enough to create a spike at the cell body? Not knowing what dendrite spikes are for, AI researchers use simulated neurons that don't have them. They also don't have dendrites and the many thousands of synapses found on the dendrites. I knew that distal synapses had to play an essential role in brain function, Any theory and any neural network that did not account for 90% of the synapses in the brain had to be wrong. The big insight I had was that dendrite spikes are predictions. A dendrite spike occurs when a set of synapses close to each other on a distal dendrite get input at the same time, and it means that the neuron has recognized a pattern of activity in some other neurons. When the pattern of activity is detected, it creates a dendrite spike, which raises the voltage at the cell body, putting the cell into what we call a predictive state. The neuron is then primed to spike. It is similar to how a runner who hears ready, set, is primed to start running. If a neuron in a predictive state subsequently gets enough proximal input to create an action potential spike, then the cell spikes a little bit sooner than it would have if the neuron was not in a predictive state. Imagine there are 10 neurons that all recognize the same pattern on their proximal synapses. This is like 10 runners on a starting line, all waiting for the same signal to begin racing. One runner hears, ready, set, and anticipates the race is about to begin. She gets in the blocks and is primed to start. When the go signal is heard, she gets off the blocks sooner than the other runners who weren't primed, who didn't hear a preparatory signal. Upon seeing the first runner off to an early lead, the other runners give up and don't even start. They wait for the next race. This kind of competition occurs throughout the neocortex. In each mini-column, multiple neurons respond to the same input pattern. They are like the runners on the starting line, all waiting for the same signal. If their preferred input arrives, they all want to start spiking. However, if one or more of the neurons are in the predictive state, our theory says only those neurons spike, and the other neurons are inhibited. Thus, when an input arrives that is unexpected, multiple neurons fire at once. If the input is predicted, then only the predictive state neurons become active. This is a common observation about the neocortex. Unexpected inputs cause a lot more activity than expected ones. If you take several thousand neurons, arrange them in mini columns, let them make connections to each other, and add a few inhibitory neurons, the neurons solve the name that tune problem. They don't get confused by repeated subsequences, and collectively, they predict the next element in the sequence. The trick to making this work was a new understanding of the neuron. We previously knew that prediction is a ubiquitous function of the brain, but we didn't know how or where predictions are made. With this discovery, we understood that most predictions occur inside neurons. A prediction occurs when a neuron recognizes a pattern, creates a dendrite spike, and is primed to spike earlier than other neurons. With thousands of distal synapses, each neuron can recognize hundreds of patterns that predict when the neuron should become active. Prediction is built into the fabric of the neocortex, the neuron. We spent over a year testing the new neuron model and sequence memory circuit. We wrote software simulations that tested its capacity and were surprised to find that as few as 20,000 neurons can learn thousands of complete sequences. We found that the sequence memory continued to work even if 30% of the neurons died or if the input was noisy. The more time we spent testing our theory, the more confidence we gained that it truly captured what was happening in the neocortex. We also found increasing empirical evidence from experimental labs that supported our idea. For example, the theory predicts that dendrite spikes behave in some specific ways, but at first, we couldn't find conclusive experimental evidence. However, by talking to experimentalists, we were able to get a clearer understanding of their findings and see that the data were consistent with what we predicted. We first published the theory in a white paper in 2011. We followed this with a peer-reviewed journal paper in 2016 titled, "Why Neurons Have Thousands of Synapses: A Theory of Sequence Memory in the Neocortex." The reaction to the paper was heartening, as it quickly became the most read paper in its journal. Discovery number 3. The secret of the cortical column is reference frames. Next, we turned our attention to the second half of the prediction problem. How does the neocortex predict the next input when we move? Unlike a melody, the order of inputs in this situation is not fixed, as it depends on which way we move. For example, if I look left, I see one thing. If I look right, I see something else. For a cortical column to predict its next input, it must know what movement is about to occur. Predicting the next input in a sequence and predicting the next input when we move are similar problems. We realized that our sequence memory circuit could make both types of predictions if the neurons were given an additional input that represented how the sensor was moving. However, we did not know what the movement-related signal should look like. We started with the simplest thing we could think of. What if the movement-related signal was just move left or move right? We tested this idea, and it worked. We even built a little robot arm that predicted its input as it moved left and right, and we demonstrated it at a neuroscience conference. However, our robot arm had limitations. It worked for simple problems, such as moving in two directions. But when we tried to scale it to work with the complexity of the real world, such as moving in multiple directions at the same time, it required too much training. We felt we were close to the correct solution, but something was wrong. We tried several variations with no success. It was frustrating. After several months, we got bogged down. We could not see a way to solve the problem. So we put this question aside and worked on other things for a while. Toward the end of February 2016, I was in my office waiting for my spouse, Janet, to join me for lunch. I was holding a Numenta coffee cup in my hand and observed my fingers touching it. I asked myself a simple question. What does my brain need to know to predict what my fingers will feel as they move? If one of my fingers is on the side of the cup and I move it toward the top, my brain predicts that I will feel the rounded curve of the lip. My brain makes this prediction before my finger touches the lip. What does the brain need to know to make this prediction? The answer was easy to state. The brain needs to know two things: what object it is touching, in this case the coffee cup, and where my finger will be on the cup after my finger moves. Notice that the brain needs to know where my finger is relative to the cup. It doesn't matter where my finger is relative to my body, and it doesn't matter where the cup is or how it's positioned. The cup can be tilted left or right. It could be in front of me or off to the side. What matters is the location of my finger relative to the cup. This observation means there must be neurons in the neocortex that represent the location of my finger in a reference frame that is attached to the cup. The movement-related signal we had been searching for, the signal we needed to predict the next input, was location on the object. You probably learned about reference frames in high school. The X, Y, and Z axes that define the location of something in space are an example of a reference frame. Another familiar example is latitude and longitude, which define locations on the surface of Earth. At first, it was hard for us to imagine how neurons could represent something like X, Y, and Z coordinates. But even more puzzling was that neurons could attach a reference frame to an object like a coffee cup. The cup's reference frame is relative to the cup. Therefore, the reference frame must move with the cup. Imagine an office chair. My brain predicts what I will feel when I touch the chair, just as my brain predicts what I will feel when I touch the coffee cup. Therefore, there must be neurons in my neocortex that know the location of my finger relative to the chair, meaning that my neocortex must establish a reference frame that is fixed to the chair. If I spin the chair in a circle, the reference frame spins with it. If I flip the chair over, the reference frame flips over. You can think of the reference frame as an invisible three-dimensional grid surrounding and attached to the chair. Neurons are simple things. It was hard to imagine that they could create and attach reference frames to objects, even as those objects were moving and rotating out in the world. But it got even more surprising. Different parts of my body, fingertips, palm, lips, might touch the coffee cup at the same time. Each part of my body that touches the cup makes a separate prediction of what it will feel based on its unique location on the cup. Therefore, the brain isn't making one prediction. It's making dozens or even hundreds of predictions at the same time. the neocortex must know the location relative to the cup of every part of my body that is touching it. Vision, I realized, is doing the same thing as touch. Patches of retina are analogous to patches of skin. Each patch of your retina sees only a small part of an entire object, in the same way that each patch of your skin touches only a small part of an object. The brain doesn't process a picture. It starts with a picture on the back of the eye, but then breaks it up into hundreds of pieces. It then assigns each piece to a location relative to the object being observed. Creating reference frames and tracking locations is not a trivial task. I knew it would take several different types of neurons and multiple layers of cells to make these calculations. Since the complex circuitry in every cortical column is similar, locations and reference frames must be universal properties of the neocortex. Each column in the neocortex, whether it represents visual input, tactile input, auditory input, language, or high-level thought, must have neurons that represent reference frames and locations. Up to that point, most neuroscientists, including me, thought that the neocortex primarily processed sensory input. What I realized that day is that we need to think of the neocortex as primarily processing reference frames. Most of the circuitry is there to create reference frames and track locations. Sensory input is, of course, essential. As I will explain in coming chapters, the brain builds models of the world by associating sensory input with locations in reference frames. Why are reference frames so important? What does the brain gain from having them? First, a reference frame allows the brain to learn the structure of something. A coffee cup is a thing because it is composed of a set of features and surfaces arranged relative to each other in space. Similarly, a face is a nose, eyes, and mouth arranged in relative positions. You need a reference frame to specify the relative positions and structure of objects. Second, by defining an object using a reference frame, the brain can manipulate the entire object at once. For example, a car has many features arranged relative to each other. Once we learn a car, we can imagine what it looks like from different points of view, or if it were stretched in one dimension. To accomplish these feats, the brain only has to rotate or stretch the reference frame, and all the features of the car rotate and stretch with it. Third, a reference frame is needed to plan and create movements. Say, my finger is touching the front of my phone, and I want to press the power button at the top. If my brain knows the current location of my finger and the location of the power button, then it can calculate the movement needed to get my finger from its current location to the desired new one. A reference frame relative to the phone is needed to make this calculation. Reference frames are used in many fields. Roboticists rely on them to plan the movement of a robot's arm or body. Reference frames are also used in animated films to render characters as they move. A few people had suggested that reference frames might be needed for certain AI applications. But as far as I know, there had not been any significant discussion that the neocortex worked on reference frames, and that the function of most of the neurons in each cortical column is to create reference frames and track locations. Now, it seems obvious to me. Vernon Mountcastle argued, there was a universal algorithm that exists in every cortical column, yet he didn't know what the algorithm was. Francis Crick wrote that we needed a new framework to understand the brain, yet he, too, didn't know what that framework should be. That day in 2016, holding the cup in my hand, I realized Mountcastle's algorithm and Crick's framework were both based on reference frames. I didn't yet understand how neurons could do this, but I knew it must be true. Reference frames were the missing ingredient, the key to unraveling the mystery of the neocortex and to understanding intelligence. All these ideas about locations and reference frames occurred to me in what seemed like a second. I was so excited that I jumped out of my chair and ran to tell my colleague Subutai Ahmed. As I raced the 20 feet to his desk, I ran into Janet and almost knocked her over. I was anxious to talk to Subutai, but while I was steadying Janet and apologizing to her, I realized it would be wiser to talk to him later. Janet and I discussed reference frames and locations as we shared a frozen yogurt. This is a good point to address a question I'm often asked. How can I speak confidently about a theory if it hasn't been tested experimentally? I just described one of these situations. I had an insight that the neocortex is infused with reference frames, and I immediately started talking about it with certainty. As I write this book, there is growing evidence to support this new idea, but it still has not been thoroughly tested, and yet I have no hesitation describing this idea as a fact. Here is why. As we work on a problem, we uncover what I call constraints. Constraints are things that the solution to the problem must address. I gave a few examples of constraints when describing sequence memory. For example, the name that tune requirement. The anatomy and physiology of the brain are also constraints. Brain theory must ultimately explain all the details of the brain, and a correct theory cannot violate any of those details. The longer you work on a problem, the more constraints you discover, and the harder it becomes to imagine a solution. The aha moments I described in this chapter were about problems that we worked on for years. Therefore, we understood these problems deeply, and our list of constraints was long. The likelihood that a solution is correct increases exponentially with the number of constraints it satisfies. It's like solving a crossword puzzle. There are often several words that match an individual clue. If you pick one of those words, it could be wrong. If you find two intersecting words that work, then it is much more likely they are both correct. If you find 10 intersecting words, the chance that they are all wrong is minuscule. You can write the answer in ink without any worries. Aha moments occur when a new idea satisfies multiple constraints. The longer you have worked on a problem, and consequently, the more constraints the solution resolves, the bigger the aha feeling, and the more confident you are in trusting the answer. The idea that the neocortex is infused with reference frames solved so many constraints that I immediately knew it was correct. It took us over 3 years to work out the implications of this discovery, and as I write, we are still not done. We have published several papers on it so far. The first paper is titled, A Theory of How Columns in the Neocortex Enable Learning the Structure of the World. This paper starts with the same circuit we described in the 2016 paper on neurons and sequence memory. We then added one layer of neurons representing location and a second layer representing the object being sensed. With these additions, we showed that a single cortical column could learn the three-dimensional shape of objects by sensing and moving and sensing and moving. For example, imagine reaching into a black box and touching a novel object with one finger. You can learn the shape of the entire object by moving your finger over its edges. Our paper explained how a single cortical column can do this. We also showed how a column can recognize a previously learned object in the same manner, for example, by moving a finger. We then showed how multiple columns in the neocortex work together to more quickly recognize objects. For example, if you reach into the black box and grab an unknown object with your entire hand, you can recognize it with fewer movements, and in some cases, in a single grasp. We were nervous about submitting this paper and debated whether we should wait. We were proposing that the entire neocortex worked by creating reference frames, with many thousands active simultaneously. This was a radical idea, and yet we had no proposal for how neurons actually created reference frames. Our argument was something like, we deduced that locations and reference frames must exist, and assuming they do exist, here is how a cortical column might work. And, oh, by the way, we don't know how neurons could actually create reference frames. We decided to submit the paper anyway. I asked myself, would I want to read this paper, even though it was incomplete? My answer was, yes. The idea that the neocortex represents locations and reference frames in every column was too exciting to hold back just because we didn't know how neurons did it. I was confident the basic idea was correct. It takes a long time to put together a paper. The prose alone can take months to write, and there are often simulations to run which can take additional months. Toward the end of this process, I had an idea that we added to the paper just prior to submitting. I suggested that we might find the answer to how neurons in the neocortex create reference frames by looking at an older part of the brain called the entorhinal cortex. By the time the paper was accepted a few months later, we knew this conjecture was correct, as I will discuss in the next chapter. We just covered a lot of ground, so let's do a quick review. The goal of this chapter was to introduce you to the idea that every cortical column in the neocortex creates reference frames. I walked you through the steps we took to reach this conclusion. We started with the idea that the neocortex learns a rich and detailed model of the world, which it uses to constantly predict what its next sensory inputs will be. We then asked how neurons can make these predictions. This led us to a new theory that most predictions are represented by dendrite spikes that temporarily change the voltage inside a neuron and make a neuron fire a little bit sooner than it would otherwise. Predictions are not sent along the cell's axon to other neurons, which explains why we are unaware of most of them. We then showed how circuits in the neocortex that use the new neuron model can learn and predict sequences. We applied this idea to the question of how such a circuit could predict the next sensory input when the inputs are changing due to our own movements. To make these sensory motor predictions, we deduced that each cortical column must know the location of its input relative to the object being sensed. To do that, a cortical column requires a reference frame that is fixed to the object.